Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is.
I'm David Pello, and I'm a faculty member at the University of California, Santa Barbara.
And thank you so much for doing this, Prof. David. It's greatly appreciated. And I'd like to begin, as I typically do, by asking you what's currently preoccupying, dynamizing, retarding, interesting you?
Well, I would say, first of all, thank you for having me on the podcast, Dr. Miller. So it's a real pleasure and an honor. I would say yes. One thing that I think is occupying and dynamiting and retarding me, and probably a whole lot of other people, is is the conflict, the war in the Middle East right now. And I'm certainly thinking about that for a number of reasons. I have a number of students who are Palestinian or who are from that part of the world whose family and friends are being affected. I have a whole list of other students from wonderful groups like Jewish Voice for Peace, who are engaging in interesting conversations with their family members and members of that particular community, and who are pushing I think a particularly generative conversation on my campus. And Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Voice for Peace are and Academics for Justice in Palestine, for example, are three amazing groups that are really putting this front and center for me. And it's every day very much top of mind, and of course connects to things I'm interested in the classroom and in my research as well, particularly around institutional violence and environmental justice. So that's one thing for sure that's preoccupying me.
And when you mentioned some Jewish groups for peace, Prof. David, and in particular the idea or the reality, it seems that they're having some, I think you used the expression, interesting conversations with family members. With a number of faculty that I've spoken to across the US for this series since October, they refer to faculty administrations being very pro the State of Israel in its current conduct, and the student body being split, but with considerable force on all sides, as it were. How would you describe things at Santa Barbara in those terms?
I would say that tracks pretty well. I would say with a little bit of a caveat, I've spoken with faculty at other universities, certainly in the States, who have, for the most part, have said that they can barely even have a conversation with their administration about this. And here at UC Santa Barbara, I would say that's very, very different. And I'm delighted to share with you that both our chancellor and the executive vice chancellor, so the number one and number two administrators at our campus, have had standing meetings with our organization, which is not an official organization, but it's Academics for Justice in Palestine. And even if we don't agree, on the politics, they've they kept the door open. They've allowed us to open the door. And we have these conversations, and it's much more conducive and generative to maintaining I think what I think is a more robust sort of campus climate where people can agree to disagree, but at the very least they can voice their views on this without being shut down. There've been some challenges there, but yes, I would agree with that caveat. The trend that you pointed out is pretty much holding quite well here. We do have a split student body and vocal on all sides of that issue. So,
Well, which is a good thing. That
yes.
one of the things that I find very frustrating here in Spain, and it's really true in Latin America, is this constant drumbeat in general terms of the horror of polarization. Whereas polarization can be very uncomfortable, but it might be quite real and for good reason. Could you tell us a little bit, David, about Academics for Justice in Palestine?
Yes, so this is a collective of faculty, but it also includes staff and students who came together after the attacks of October 7th by Hamas on Israelis. And but we built on the work that a number of scholars, of faculty members, and students and staff here at UC Santa Barbara have been doing for many years in terms of not only supporting a free Palestine, but really trying to build bridges between anti-Zionist communities across the spectrum, and who have supported Students for Justice in Palestine for many years. Jewish Voice for Peace is now new on our campus and is in the process of getting formal recognition. But Academics for Justice in Palestine, we have held weekly strategizing and organizing meetings since October 7th. We have held weekly public poetry readings, which have been really, really impressive and emotional, with people from all walks of life showing up, participating in the audience, reading poetry. And we've had several teach-ins, which we were just having a planning meeting last night, and we're joking about. For whatever reason, we continue to host our public events, our teach-ins, on the last Friday of every term, and since October 7th, and we don't expect many people to show up, but in fact they do. It's been standing room only, and we have had students who are in some cases who are literally born and raised in Israel. Some students who are representing groups like Hillel, students supporting Israel, students who are themselves Zionist, who will show up at these meetings not to be disruptive, but to actually engage and to express their views. And I take that as a really positive sign that for whatever reason, Academics for Justice in Palestine has created a space that is welcoming to all. And we've been able to have some really robust conversations and have taken a lot of action as well. An affiliated organization, our collective, I would say, is called Researchers Against War. And they are doing exactly that, researching the connections between our institution and the military-industrial complex, and figuring out points of intervention and where we can address and confront and reduce those impacts with an eye toward preventing future war and future genocide and the ecological harm that comes with that. So,
I was going to pick up on that last point actually and ask you about it because you're in an environmental studies area as a sociologist. And one of the areas that I've looked at in the last few years has been the ecological impact of the decade-long conflict in Colombia, where bodies, bombs, bullets, guns, knives, grenades end up in one of the longest rivers in the world that is in Colombia with a really appalling ecological impact. And I wondered if, but I'm not an expert on this topic in general. And I know there are many areas of environmental life that you look into, but I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about just that question of the impact of war on the environment.
Yes, no, it's an enormously important question, and I'm really glad you're raising that point. I mean, I certainly wouldn't claim to be an expert on that particular issue, but it's quite massive. And in fact, certainly in my field, in sort of environmental justice studies and the social sciences that intersect with that, there's certainly a strong consensus that, and this is probably an obvious point and maybe beyond debate, but certainly a strong consensus that war is really, without a doubt, the single most ecologically, and I would argue socially, harmful activity that humans can engage in. And I mean, clearly, I mean, we're just devastating ecosystems, devastating food systems, devastating our air, land, water, impacting people's physical and mental health is truly extraordinary. I think, and so for me, one of the important things as somebody who's focused on environmental justice and climate justice is to try to make those linkages as well, and to think about maybe the environmental justice movement, the climate justice movement, really is just is a one of many more recent iterations of the long-standing, decades, centuries-long peace movements, right? And maybe there are ways that we can much more deliberately draw some of those connections. And so, if you'll bear with me, I mean, one of the things I've been sort of grappling with and sort of, and playing with is, in the field of environmental justice studies, I mean, I think like in a lot of fields, one of the tasks of scholars and activists is to get people to maybe think differently about a certain phenomenon to perhaps spark more interesting and productive conversations and actions. And along that line, and actually reading some scholarship on Latin American elites and American elites, collaborating on counterinsurgency campaigns in Latin America to crush various people's movements to create a better life in their communities. I've come to the conclusion that one way of recasting environmental injustice, or more specifically environmental racism, might be to actually think of it as a form of warfare, for a number of reasons. I mean, one is environmental injustice really does involve, not only institutional violence, but direct assaults by states and state-supported organizations on entire communities that really result in massive harm to those communities and the ecosystems that they really depend on. And it's also the flip side, of course, is like every war that I'm aware of, environmental injustice is also designed to maintain the health of those groups who are deemed valuable, who are deemed worthy of consideration. And without being too dramatic, I mean, I think it's safe to say that environmental injustice reflects a way in which environmental privilege can be weaponized, and in ways in which these communities that are struggling for environmental justice can be seen as legitimate targets and even enemies whose bodies, whose territories, whose ecosystems, and even knowledge systems and identities are fair game for containment, neutralization, and even destruction. The last point I'll make really deals with the psychology of this, and I'm certainly not an expert on that, but reading in a recent article, I guess it came out a couple of years ago, looking at counterinsurgency warfare in Latin America. This piece used this term social warfare, which is, I think we're probably all very familiar with this idea, that the idea of containing and managing and channeling dissent into more acceptable form and less disruptive forms of activism. Here's a seat at the table, give the non-governmental organizations some money. And there's a real way in which that's a psychological dimension of warfare. And so I think if that's the case, then if environmental injustice is a form of warfare, then we really do need to think more productively about what a response to that might look like. And I look at the response, or the responses to the genocide in Palestine, and I think that's a perfect example where people are coming together across various differences. People are engaging in peaceful, loving, nonviolent, but truly impactful actions. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, people are reading poetry, documenting connections between our educational institutions and the war machine, with an eye to at the very least rolling that back. And so I'm trying to think the very beginning of stages of thinking about how the environmental justice movement and scholarship might indeed be a de-escalation and a peace movement. So those are just some random thoughts that are coming to mind for me.
Oh, beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing those. And certainly, what are sometimes called environmental defenders, sometimes social leaders amongst both indigenous and Afro-descended groups in Brazil and Colombia and so on, are murdered every day. And they're murdered by proxies of the state and proxies of the big extractive corporations. Now, I once was sitting on a plane, guilty. Anecdotal gossip with a guy who was an executive for a major extraction company that's based in the Netherlands and the UK. So that tells you what it was. And he said, "Yeah, it's true. I know. They said we hire people to go and kill them."
Wow,
Just
my
absolutely
goodness.
straightforward. He was a technocrat. He didn't want this stuff to happen. And I said, "Can I quote you on that?" And he said, "You don't know my name." So who knows whether he was even what he said he was. These conversations on transport can sometimes produce bizarre outcomes. But I wanted to touch on the area of your work that first came to my attention, Prof, which was the Silicon Valley of dreams and challenging the chip, because this work struck me as being very important in two ways that I'd like you to comment on. One, it sheds a light on an area that is not often thought about in the bourgeois media, for example, as being guilty of environmental despoliation, unlike extraction, unlike air travel, unlike the military, etc., unlike manufacturing. But secondly, it shed a light on working people as victims and survivors and resistors of environmental despoliation, thereby building a bridge to the proletariat and other groups, rather than there being this opposition of a middle-class environmentalism versus the needs of the working person. So I wondered if you could comment on perhaps on those two aspects, and on that part of your work.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. I would say first I'll give credit to grassroots organizations like the Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition and the Santa Clara Center for Occupational Safety and Health for first bringing these issues to my attention, and certainly I'm one of a number of scholars who have looked at this, and I certainly was not the first, but yes, you raised some really important points. The first of which is that, yeah, the IT industry, the electronics industry, has, I think, even to this day, successfully produced this veneer, this image of being not only sort of non-polluting and not a sort of source of ecological harm or and catastrophe like oil, iron, steel, you name it, deforestation, timber, but has really successfully produced that veneer in co collaboration with elected officials and other so-called thought leaders, and it's been quite effective. And so it's been very difficult in some cases to even convince people that this is an issue. But yes, I mean, some have said that this industry is second only, perhaps to the nuclear industry in terms of polluting our planet. It's extraordinary. In Silicon Valley, in California, there's one fairly small space, geographic space, where some, oh, I think 11 companies have created an underground toxic chemical plume that some years ago, scientists estimated would have taken 300 years for the government to clean up. I mean, and that 300 years, that's older than the United States itself. And so, just to put things into perspective, so this is a very, very toxic industry indeed. And I think the reason why we now know it is because of the good work not only of grassroots activists, a number of scientists and scholars who've been documenting this, but as you said, largely because many of the workers in this industry have really been blowing the whistle and placing themselves at great risk and jeopardy of losing their jobs and coming under all sorts of other harms. But yes, I think this is a really important example that really demonstrates, as you said, that this sort of jobs versus environment, this cultural and political divide between the environmental movement and the labor movement need not be seen as sort of natural or inevitable or organic. This is, the IT industry, the electronics industry is one where certainly for the workers, the toxins and their impacts, as difficult as they might be to document and to prove in a courtroom, in a legal system, even in under scientific experimental conditions, they're pretty obvious to most people. And I would say it's the workers who've been most impacted by these chemical hazards who've really been at the forefront of leadership on this. And we've seen this in Europe, we've seen this in Latin America, the United States, Canada, and certainly across much of Asia, with to great effect, where we've seen real dramatic and I think important changes that this movement has made in terms of getting this industry to be more responsible, more sustainable, more equitable. But one step forward, two steps back. It's the price of success is eternal vigilance, and these folks have quite a strong grip on the various infrastructures of power, both politically, economically, and certainly culturally. But one organization I want to lift up, and last thing I'll say on this is the International Campaign for Responsible Technology. And I think for the last 20 some odd years, they've done an enormously important job of promoting this good work of lifting up the struggles of workers in fence line communities, residential communities impacted by this industry, and promoting legislation, but also practices within this industry that are much more just and equitable. But yeah, a long way to go. A long way to go.
One of the things that interests me, Prof. David, is that when I look at epidemiology and medical studies of workers in the informal sector engaged in illegal or extra-legal recycling of environmental materials, again and again, the leading scholars doing this are based in West Africa, South Asia, Malaysia, Latin America. They're not Africans or South Asians or Latin Americans in the global north. They're in their own countries, and Chinese scholars also. These are the people who are really bringing knowledge to the fore on this. And it's astonishing how little is done in the global north on these topics. Now, of course, reasonable to say that India and China are now, certainly centers of monumental middle class use of these technologies. And so not only have there been millions of victims involved in the manufacture and the recycling of these items, but now there are millions and millions who are culpable at some level. But I do think that it's very significant that this is an area where so much formal knowledge comes from the global south, as well as from social movements, as you say. Non-government organizations, yeah.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And in the book Challenging the Chip, that I co-edited with some other folks, and was a good example of us bringing together scholars, but and also leaders from non-governmental organizations from the global north, but also primarily from the global south, to have these conversations to reflect that knowledge of experience, that expertise that comes with that experience from the global south, and yes, to pull back that veneer of sort of purity of environmental responsibility that this industry has enjoyed for too long. And as you said, it's a really, really important point that I don't think enough folks in the global north have paid attention to. And those of us in the global north, I think, who have in the past paid attention to this phenomenon of certainly of electronic waste, e-waste flows, have primarily seen it as this problem of e-waste flowing from north to south, which is certainly historically and even contemporarily a major problem. But as you said, the growth of the middle classes in places like India and China have complicated that rather sort of simple analysis. And as you said, so much of that waste that is indeed harming workers and fence line communities in places like Ghana and India and China is also being produced by the wealthy and the middle class within those communities. So yeah, we've got a lot of work to do on that front as well domestically. And I think you're right. It's a thorny issue. We want to be careful, those of us like myself in the global north, trying to prescribe sort of a path forward for someone in different communities in the global south. So listening, being humble, and collaborating as I think you did is
And this
important.
environmental justice question is immensely complicated. Because it's quite clear that European and US imperialism are the key nodes in the environmental catastrophe that we face, even as there are actors that are thought of as being in the global south who are hugely responsible for the contemporary despoliation. And of course, there are also places, I think in particular of Norway and Australia, that per capita are probably the most laden with environmental criminality of all countries in history, in terms of their contributions to dirty forms of energy. I wanted to ask you, Prof, about environmental racism, which you've mentioned. And not just at the international level, but the national, because I'm thinking of a book that you wrote, what, back, as they say in baseball commentary, a long time ago, Garbage Wars, which is looking at questions in Chicago, the historically the second city of the United States, whatever we wherever we rank it today, and where race and garbage and class are so thoroughly intertwined historically. You could say the same about New York City or LA. I wonder if you can remember that book. This is not the Committee on Academic Personnel questioning you, Prof. Sorry, sort of in-house University of California. What were the garbage wars, and what's the state of play now?
Yes. So this is a book that that really came out of, well, it came out of my dissertation, which I want to give credit to the late great activist Hazel Johnson and her daughter Cheryl Johnson, who at the time were running this organization, People for Community Recovery, an environmental justice organization on the south side of Chicago. Cheryl Johnson still runs that organization today. Well, we were dealing with, as you said, the garbage wars, which was and remains this problem of, certainly America produces an inordinate amount of municipal solid waste, hazardous waste, et cetera. And going back to the early 80s, when this organization, People for Community Recovery, was founded, they'd been fighting against hazardous waste incinerators, municipal landfills, a sewage waste treatment plant that was literally across the street from their community. And I mean, it was extraordinary. I mean, this is hellish. I mean, you can't live in this community. You can't pass through this community without being assaulted by just, the aerial and every other sort of form and medium of pollution. It hits your olfactory senses the moment you're even within 5,000 yards of this community. It's really, really amazing. It's horrifying. And yet, to go back to the sort of the warfare sort of metaphor, people who and I think it's true that when you wake up in a community, a contaminated community like this, the idea is that, well, I'm worth less, and I'm not going to fight back. The dominant institutions have succeeded in breaking my will to resist and to survive. Not so in communities like this. Again and again and again, that maneuver backfires, and people sort of rise up and rebel. And back in 1987, this organization led, for example, a collaborative movement with Greenpeace. Greenpeace was the ally, the supportive element in this action, where they did a lockdown in the middle of a street to prevent hazardous waste trucks from coming into their community on the, in Altgeld Gardens, a public housing project on the south side of Chicago. And in 3 scant hours, they turned back 57 waste trucks. I mean, that's an enormous amount of waste, hazardous chemical waste, going into this one facility. And they eventually shut down that facility, thus having a dramatically positive impact on the air quality there. But as I show in the book, these garbage wars have been going, in Chicago, going on, raging since at least 1880, when immigrant communities, European immigrant communities, were dealing with much the same thing. Waste incinerators, waste dumps, et cetera, literally in their communities, right next door to their communities, and having to deal with those assaults and pushing back. As early as 1881, there was a smoke control ordinance passed in Chicago, one of the first in the nation, and really trying to regulate and reduce the amount of pollution coming out of these smokestacks. But as you said, race and class are closely intertwined and can sometimes serve as a wedge, but also can serve as a way to bring people together. And so we saw in Chicago, and we see it today, a multiracial, multi-ethnic, multi-class movement of folks who understand that, as much as it is true that certain communities are hit harder and hardest, all of these communities, particularly on the south side and the west side, are suffering under air pollution. And really, it serves no one but the people in power if these communities remain divided. And so, I've been quite heartened to see these folks come together across these demographic lines, and to build a really powerful movement for sustainability and equity.
Speaking about such questions, one of the contentious issues amongst the environmental movement, within the environmental movement and outside it, is a twinning of what has been called environmental colonialism and also the whiteness of many of the key non-government organizations, some of which you've mentioned. I wondered if you could comment on the notion of environmental colonialism, where that plays in your mind or doesn't, and also on this issue of the people who tend to predominate in the big multinational environmental bodies, WWF, which is not a wrestling organization. It used to be called World Wildlife Fund or Greenpeace or Friends of the Earth, as opposed to the more local specific ones that you mentioned per Chicago. So environmental colonialism and the whiteness of the movement.
Yeah, it's a real problem, and has been, you know, for decades. I mean, there's, you know, this notion of conservation that has really undergirded so much of the environmental movement in the West, which has really focused on, you know, creating spaces that are protected from human activities and despoilation, and, you know, which sounds like a really great idea, but in so many cases, unfortunately, this has led to literally the dispossession and the expulsion of indigenous peoples, of Adivasis, of tribal folks, and who have been stewarding the land very effectively for generations, for centuries, and in many cases for millennia. And so many of the international non-governmental organizations that you've mentioned, and I'm certainly also thinking of like the Nature Conservancy and many others who have perpetrated this problem. Mark Dowie is I think is a journalist who's written widely on this issue, the 100-year war, conservation war that's been led against indigenous peoples in various parts of the world has led to a great deal of problems, and including actually not even achieving the aim of ecological sustainability, and really rests on a sort of a fundamental and foundational misconception of how we might promote improved ecological health, that, you know, we actually need human beings to help steward these ecosystems in collaboration with other species. So, but yes, the whiteness of the movement is and remains a problem. I would say, you know, I think we are seeing some real success there. I'm pleased to say, as a former board member of Greenpeace USA, we are the first, I think, what we would call a legacy environmental organization that is headed by a woman of color, a Black woman. Her name is Ebony Twiley Martin. We see the Sierra Club also now has an African American leader in the United States, Ben Jealous, who's formerly of the NAACP. Whether that actually will translate into practices and policies and collaborations that reflect a deeper analytic, a deeper transformation of thinking and action. And speaking of multi-species, I'm loving your feline friend there. that remains to be seen. I will say, in Greenpeace's case, I'm delighted to see that Greenpeace has unionized their staff, and that happened under Ebony Martin when she was co-directing with the great Annie Leonard. We are seeing similar activities occurring at other primarily white environmental organizations. So there is this sense that social justice, environmental justice, equity, these important concerns are slowly but surely having an impact on these
And they're being
organizations.
linked. And is Annie Leonard still at Greenpeace, by the way?
My understanding is that, so don't quote me on this. You don't know my name, do you? No, I'm kidding. She has, I think, an informal advisory capacity, but
To Greenpeace.
she's formally no longer the executive director.
But as you
Yes.
say, has made wonderful contributions. Speaking of interspecies collaboration and our fellow animals, that was the podcat whose formal name is Chinguri, which is a Basque word rather than Indo-European. And it's translated into Castilian as hormiga, which means ant, which is a slightly strange word for a cat. I think you'd agree. So he's been renamed Orange or Naranja. Although some critics say that he is becoming more and more vanilla. One of the interesting things about the orange cat is that 80% of them are male. It's one of these strange genetic trails that I still don't really understand. Anyway, that leads me to asking you about another really important book, Total Liberation. This is what you promise. And the cover of your book has an exclamation point, and the point at the bottom is the globe, but it's also pause, PAWS. So, Prof, you certainly are, you may be afraid, but you appear unafraid to take on some of the big and really contentious questions of our time. And one of the areas where I find, in the several countries where I've been teaching, students, especially in the US, take exception is the idea of animal rights. And this is partly due to immense propaganda that they've received. I wondered if you could explain to us how setting Chinguri free will liberate the world.
it's a pleasure to meet Chinguri, and yeah, I would agree. What a beautiful cat. Orange and vanilla combination is just coming through the screen. I'm loving that. Well, I guess I would say the total liberation was I'm glad you brought that up because it was definitely, I think, for certainly readers, however few there may be of my work, who think of me as, this environmental justice scholar, activist who's focused on kind of assaults on human beings primarily and their environments secondarily, and how people are responding to that and trying to build, this rather impressive and powerful movement. Why would I be concerned about it, about animal rights and the question of sort of eco-terrorism, animal rights terrorism, et cetera? It definitely felt like, I think for many people, a departure. But I was really taken by a group of animal rights and radical environmentalists who are anarchists, who I fell in with in the Twin Cities of Minnesota and St. Paul. And Minneapolis, St. Paul and Minneapolis, Minnesota, some years ago, and just began asking questions like, to what extent are these radical animal liberation activists and movements also struggles over social justice and social inequality, and what sorts of productive engagements with non-human natures do these movements really reveal? And I was also very much interested in what are the social implications of the eco-terrorist label that was being sort of imposed on these folks. And I will say, I mean, as much as I became, it was very clear that a fair number, and maybe even the majority of folks in the animal rights community aren't terribly focused on social justice across species, there are enough of these folks who really, really inspired and motivated me. And so one of the things that was pointed out very clearly, and to me, and of course we can see this going back millennia in other traditions, including indigenous some indigenous cosmologies, is that these borders and boundaries between the human and the non-human are really constructed or artificial and in some ways unnatural, if you will, and certainly destructive. And so the idea of total liberation, at least in this context, is that we need to think about intersectionality not just as this mechanism, this analytic that allows us to think about race, class, gender, sexuality, ability, citizenship, et cetera, but we should also use that as a framework that allows us to jump the species boundary and to understand how the differences that we have constructed between species really reinforce unjust power relations, not only between humans and non-humans, but within the human community as well. And so eco-feminists, of course, have long made this point, and I was borrowing from their ideas as well. But yes, I think the idea is that if non-humans enjoy the bounties of life, our ability to the ability to flourish and thrive, those of us who are human are much more likely to live in spaces of freedom. And that the last thing I'll say on that is just recognizing that our societies have always been multi-species societies. And so if that's the case, what do we need to do to think of our systems of governance, our polities, as multi-species? And again, many other people have written and thought and move through the world with that orientation long before I came along. But they really got me thinking about that, and I'm still grappling with that.
And one of the things that you talk about in the book is something that's very real, but I'd never heard termed this before, which is the Green Scare. And here, I guess one's troping the Red Scare, that there are communists under the bed, communists in the University of California, and God damn it, we're everywhere. What's the Green Scare, Prof?
The Green Scare is, as you said, it's definitely a riff off of the Red Scare. And some, of course, would say that there were, at least in the United States, two Red Scares. But yes, the Green Scare was this very concerted, and I would argue is still ongoing, effort by government and their corporate allies and their allies in the media, and certainly in the court systems, to really paint these radical animal rights, animal liberation, and environmental movements as terrorists, as eco-terrorists, as threats to national security. And this despite the fact that certainly, as far as I know, in the United States, those movements, while have certainly have caused a great deal, hundreds of millions of dollars in damage through sabotage, through burning down research laboratories and horse slaughterhouses and whatnot, have not caused the death of a single human being or any being, as far as we know. And yet, for a time, we're labeled the single greatest threat to national security, domestically in the United States. And so the only conclusion that I could draw from that, rather ridiculous assertion and claim by the government, is that the real threat is at least twofold. One is, of course, financial. These folks have indeed, in the pursuit of total liberation and freeing animals, have indeed caused a great deal of economic damage. But perhaps more profoundly, have a thesis, an articulated theory of change that claims, that declares quite boldly, that we don't need just to focus on civil rights and human rights and social justice for human beings, but in order to transform and bring down this system, we have to actually draw those connections to the domination of our ecosystems and non-humans. And there's proof that this is a deep concern within the government, certainly of the United States. Some redacted and revealed documents from the FBI and various police departments have made that same point, that these people are dangerous because they believe that we need to dispel any notion and destroy any notion of hierarchy. And so I think that's a really powerful example of how an idea can pose a really important threat to systems of dominance.
I wanted to ask you about a more recent volume that's, I imagine, become a textbook. What is Critical Environmental Justice Studies? And congratulations on that wonderful volume. Could you perhaps tell us what that is and whether or not you're able to set it to hundreds of UCSB students each quarter?
Oh, my poor students, they're quite sick of this, I'm sure. So the idea of critical environmental justice, and I want to give credit to, there's so many other scholars who, had come before me, who had been sort of chipping away at, but also trying to extend and deepen our framing and analysis of both environmental injustice, the problem, and what the solution or a vision of change, what environmental justice might look like. So just drawing on that work, I came up with these sort of four little elements or pillars, for lack of a better word, that seek to really expand the whole spectrum of social categories of difference that we're focusing on, right? This isn't just about how environment and climate affects working class people and people of color, but also, again, just that whole spectrum of social difference, including ability, citizenship, age, species, etc., just to get a deeper and broader sense of who's suffering under environmental injustice, but also to imagine and to pay attention to that rather big tent of that broad swath of humanity and post-humanity that is struggling against this. The area within critical environmental justice that I think has maybe gotten me into a little bit of hot water and sparked a good deal of discussion is, again, drawing from other scholars. I certainly didn't invent the idea of anarchism, but just being, rather critical of the fact that certainly in the States, the overwhelming majority of scholars and activists in this space really see the state and the nation state as the site of resolution for our environmental and climate injustices, despite the fact that the state has either directly perpetrated those harms or indirectly has by facilitating them. So that's something I've been engaging with. But as always, critical environmental justice is also focused on thinking through how resistance and refusal movements and thinking can pose and present alternatives. And I guess lastly, drawing from some of the great work that climate justice activists have done around, and Naomi Klein has written widely about this idea of to change everything, we need everyone. And so I've really taken that idea to heart in thinking about, well, if part of the underlying logic or driving force of environmental and climate injustice is this logic of surplus, of expendability, that some certain populations and ecosystems don't matter at all, or certainly matter less, then let's flip that on its head and be thoroughly, normative, if not ideological, and say, maybe we need a framing that says, everyone should actually be thought of as indispensable in our collective work, our multi-species work to move toward a more just society.
There's
So
a line
that's it in a nutshell.
in the Harry Bosch novels by Michael Connelly, everybody matters or nobody matters.
I love that. I
And
love
body is also non-species specific, of course. I think
that.
that's the expression. It's certainly wonderful. Prof, I'd like to finish with two more questions for you, if I may. And then to conclude, I'd like to throw it to you, lest there be things you'd like to add that we haven't mentioned. Does that sound all right as a way of drawing things to a gentle close?
Sure, certainly.
Okay, the first one is there's one group of people that we haven't really talked about directly, though they may be included in other groups, of course, which is immigrants to the United States. And I'm thinking here of your Bravura co-authored book with Lisa Soon-Hee Park, Slums of Aspen. So my second last question is to ask whether you might adumbrate that volume to us.
Yes. So, Slums of Aspen. This was a project that started when an activist from Aspen area in Colorado gave a really wonderful presentation about environmental and immigration struggles in the what is called the Roaring Fork Valley, the Roaring Fork River Valley of Colorado. And it just blew us away. And he just said, you guys need to come up to Aspen area and do a study of this. And so in a nutshell, this was, and it sort of goes back to the earlier point around sort of the whiteness of the environmental movement and the kinds of destructive thinking that might emerge from that demographic lack of diversity. And this was a case where the city council of Aspen and the county supervisors of Pitkin County, where Aspen, Colorado is based, within a very short span of time, back in 1999 and 2000, passed resolutions. They weren't even sort of legislations, but resolutions that called on the federal government of the United States to build up and militarize the border between the United States and Mexico to prevent further immigration, because for them, the calculation went this way. The leading number one cause of our environmental and climate woes on planet Earth is human population growth. And the leading cause of human population growth is immigration across national borders. Therefore, we can solve our environmental problems by getting rid of immigrants, or at least reducing their numbers. And so, yes, we engaged the history of that, spoke to a lot of activists and community members in the immigrant community and in the so-called native-born community. And it really just took us back to that long and sordid history of environmental movements and conservation movements, really imagining pure spaces that are free from
And
pesky human beings.
that takes you back to some California beach towns, some reactionary California beach towns that talk about, the idea of our wonderful Pacific Ocean being polluted by damn foreigners. Those
Yes.
damn foreigners. And of course, that only means some kind of foreigners.
Yes, exactly.
So this is incredibly important work, I think, because to recognize, we go back to Hitler was a vegetarian. There are right-wing elements of environmentalism that can be horrifying in their racism and their sexism, even as they have things in common with us, in double inverted commas, because it's so easy and understandable to focus on the corporate malfeasance, which is not from the far right at all. It's very much like liberal democracies' malfeasance. It's Clinton Democrats and their kind. So I think it is very important to focus on this anti-immigrant sentiment that can build up with the alibi of saving the environment. And I think I give great credit to both of you. So, Prof, my last question before inviting you to conclude with some final observations is to ask how you find stuff out. And this is a question from Cap. How does this guy know all this stuff? You've given us some clues. In particular, you've talked about building on the work of others or learning from others, be they scholars or be they activists. But when Prof. David is sitting down, nutting out his next lecture, his next project, his next book, what does he do? Where does he go?
Oh, I love that question. I don't think I have a very creative or insightful answer. I think probably just the usual suspects. I mean, I look at various media sources and what's going on, what are the stories of the day, and a broad range of media sources, but the usual sort of the large mainstream news organizations, and then some social media, although I try to limit my exposure to social media just for my mental health. And of course I'm always trying to follow what some of the most what I think are the most interesting activist and grassroots organizations are doing out there, and how they're framing their concerns, and they're framing their vision of the future. I never fail to learn something from them, and love inviting those folks into my classes to give far more interesting overviews and lectures than I ever will. And then of course just sort of engaging in conversations with those folks and my colleagues and family members, particularly people who aren't necessarily focused on environmental issues, but and this is, I think, the enduring success, I think the most important accomplishment of the environmental justice movement and literature is not so much in shutting down bad stuff, preventing horrible things from happening and creating this wonderful vision of the future. It's actually on the discursive sort of cultural register of really trying to change the way we talk about and think about the environment in a much more expansive way. And so, if I could just jump to the last question in terms of, one thing I'm thinking about and have been working on, this is an example, linking environment and environmental justice concerns to the prison system or carceral institutions. Those are two things that I think a lot of people, including myself, wouldn't normally connect. And I certainly didn't. And frankly, I wouldn't have done it if I was just focusing on environmental justice. The way I came to that project, looking at what I call the Prison Environmental Justice Project, was through the Total Liberation, that book, where at the very end of that book, I began to ask myself, geez, these folks were thrown into prison, thrown into jail, criminalized, surveilled, subpoenaed to grand juries because they were trying to save the earth, they were trying to free animals, etc. I wonder if there are any other intersections between the criminal legal system and environmentalism. So I literally just started Googling things, and the very first person I came up with was this amazing activist, Panayotis Tsolkas, who is an old Earth First or radical environmental activist, who was the very first person I interviewed for the Total Liberation book. And this guy, at that very moment, had started doing this work with what is called the Prison Ecology Project, where they are bringing together activists focusing on decarceration, prison abolition, and environmental justice. And so that's a wonderful example of where two issues, prisons and environment, that people don't normally connect, really have become, I think, really entangled in an
Yeah,
urgent
thanks
recession political
for
agenda.
giving that as your peroration. I don't know if it's still the case, but part of the federal prison system's enslavement project was to get men in particular to engage in unsafe recycling of electronic goods.
Yes, that's exactly right. Yes, and the Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition, I think, was one of the first groups to really uncover that at Atwater Prison in California, I think it was. So yes, and for better or for worse, I think that has contributed So again, the offshoring of some of those hazardous activities to some of the communities you had mentioned earlier where people are doing e-waste recycling.
As goes California, so does the nation, so
Right.
does the shit of the universe. So, Prof, it was wonderful getting to know you. I've been a fan of your work for many years. I greatly appreciate the time you've given to us today.
Thank you so much for this invitation. And I must say, outside of the 12 people in my family who tend to be somewhat familiar with my work, it's rare for me to come across somebody who's actually quite familiar with the whole body of work. I think you're more familiar with it than I am. So thank you for the privilege and the honor of being on your podcast. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to following your work in the future. I'm a big fan of your work. We've been in touch for many years, and you're a force of nature. So thank you so much for this invitation.